I am a god.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your foundational rite of spring of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Makeup by the mirror in her bedroom. Thigh-high fishnets and some black boots. Nose pierced with the cigarette perfume. Half dead, but she still looks so cute. She is a monster.
Who amongst us has not fallen in love with an emo girl? Really, it is a universal sentiment. And finally, it has been put to song. That is what you are listening to. That is MGK, FK, DBA, Machine Gun Kelly, DBA, MGK, with Willow off of the most recent MGK album, Mainstream Sellout, which somewhat paradoxically is his second number one album in the country. Somehow, the rise of MGK has gone unremarked upon on podcasts, but the silence on the MGK situation stops today. We are joined on podcast by two writers who have recently contributed essential pieces to the canon of writing about the pop punk phase of Machine Gun Kelly. First, back on podcast, it's Megan Garvey, who wrote the recent Billboard cover story on Machine Gun Kelly, coming from Chicago today. Megan, is that right?
Well, I'm actually in Texas, oddly enough, right now. But I don't claim Texas, so we'll just stick with Chicago.
Okay. Calling from Texas, claiming Chicago. Also, first time on podcast and coming to really, we're going to apply some deep emo theology on top of MGK. It's Ariel Gordon. Ariel, welcome.
Yeah, I've been studying for this my whole life, so.
It's exactly what I want to hear. Have we not all been studying this for our whole lives, though? I have to be honest. I went back to listen to the prior MGK record, which I hadn't listened to in a couple years. And in retrospect, now this is a self-evident thing, but there is something that feels inevitable about that album and about a guy like MGK arriving at that creative moment. And maybe it is not that surprising that a mainstream pop star of 2022 is a rehabilitated former white rapper, but someone who also grew up adjacent to the Warped Tour trenches, someone who toured with Tech N9ne, and who basically waited around for someone like Juice WRLD or Lil Peep to invent the style of music that he would then realize is just an agglomeration of all the stuff that he grew up doing anyway, and then ripping it off shamelessly. Megan, is it not just an inevitability? Is it not preordained that MGK would arrive here?
Sure thing. And I got to admit, I wasn't totally like schooled in the MGK like oeuvre of 2010 or whatever.
Yeah.
So it really came as a shock to me that you go check the tapes and like he's been playing with a live band this whole time. Who knew? Not me.
Yeah. You weren't attending the early shows? Is that what you're trying to tell me? I will say, okay, so I had an MGK awakening moment, like totally unconnected to these two albums. I think it was about 4 years ago. I happened to be backstage at Rolling Loud, and I happened to be behind the MGK performance, like behind the stage, quite literally. And I'm like, why is everybody screaming? Like, I couldn't make sense of it. And I looked up in the sky and he had climbed all the way to the top of like the stage setup and was rapping from there, and people were into it. And I could not get my head around the fact that there were thousands of people who had voluntarily chosen in the middle of a festival to attend an MGK performance. And on top of that, we're loving it. Strange world we live in. Ariel, let's talk a little bit about Mainstream Sellout, which to me is probably the lesser of the two recent MGK albums. Tell me a little bit about your vibe on the record. Where does it sit? And not just with MGK stuff, but also so much of the pop punk adjacent hip hop or hip hop adjacent pop punk of the last like 5 years.
That's a lot. I think
it is.
I agree with your assessment that Tickets to My Downfall, which is his 2020 record, is a stronger record across the board, lyrically, musically, than Mainstream Sellout, FKA, Born with Horns.
I have to get my tattoo removed also, unfortunately. what a bummer.
I know. No, it looks so good next to my Hotel Diablo tattoo. So it's a shame. But yeah, Hotel Diablo, of course, is 2018 record, which had one kind of entree into this with I Think I'm Okay, I think is the song. And that was featuring Youngblood and also was produced by somebody I think we'll talk about a lot, Travis Barker.
Yes. And
yeah, so I think that this has been a long time coming for MGK in terms of the pivot to pop punk aesthetics, but he kind of talks about it as I had nothing to lose, so why not try on a new genre? Which I think is kind of interesting. Like, he was a rapper before this, and I think obviously Megan can maybe speak more to this, but was not respected in that community. So I think it just made it an easier pivot, maybe.
Also, he had a ceiling. The odds that MGK was going to have a rap breakthrough in the year of our Lord, like 2020, it's like pretty slim. Megan, that seems fair to say, yeah?
Quite fair. I mean, the funny thing is, did you know an MGK fan before he went? I didn't know any. Not a one.
Apart from the people who I saw voluntarily watching him at Rolling Loud, I did not know. No, I do not know any MGK fans.
Amongst like friends and peers, there simply weren't any. It was like it was fascinating.
I think you said that he had been disappointed, not that his 2019 album was poorly reviewed, but that it was barely reviewed, as if it didn't matter. And I was like, dog, you are so right. That is exactly completely correct, MGK. No one was checking for it. It was not on the radar of serious critics. It was not on the radar of like fun pop crave type sites. Like, it was not on the radar of like real rap heads. It was not on the radar of kind of like alternative press types, even, I don't think.
No, and seemingly not even fun enough to like completely destroy.
Right,
people
exactly.
Are still out there doing that. Just nothing. It actually kind of like crushed me to hear him say that.
Oh, did you like him? All right, sidebar. You spent some time, right? How long did you spend with him for the story?
Probably like 6 hours at his house in an afternoon.
And what was the vibe? Do you thought he was more solid than you maybe expected him to be?
100%. 100%. Yeah, he started the day as a sullen young man, perhaps not as young as you might think. It really touched me to hear someone who just got ripped off for everything he did for years. I think it really, it's hard to put myself in those shoes.
But he charmed you over to his plight.
Very much so.
He's 31 years old, by the way. So he had nowhere to turn, or not nowhere to turn, but the road that he had been walking had hit some kind of end. There wasn't anywhere else to go.
I think if that road existed, he lit it on fire with like an Eminem diss, you know, so it's tough to go anywhere. And then I think something that you mentioned that was percolating at the time was this kind of Juice WRLD emo rap that was happening. And Travis Barker is getting a lot of attention these days because he's producing so much of these overtly pop punk records. But he was working in the rap world as well prior to that as a producer for artists like Ian Dior and other artists in that realm. So I feel like he's a really clean bridge between those genres in a way. And to MGK's telling, took him into the studio and pushed him to write his authentic self. And his authentic self shops at Hot Topic and whatever, like wears Manic Panic. And so I think that was some of the backstory to his transition. And, you know, as we talked about, he's 31. So something I mentioned, and it's hard to ignore, is like, he's working with peers, quote unquote, who are 15 years his junior, or if it's not that ridiculous, it's people who are just turning 20 and I think have less knowledge or firsthand experience of pop punk when it was first happening. But he was a real teenager when like Blink-182 was huge. And I think maybe he deserves some credit on Tickets to My Downfall for bringing this back in an authentic way.
Heavy quotes on authentic.
Maybe I am going to be his only defender, but the Halsey vocals on that album, there are just some moments on that album that feel earnestly as impactful as Paramore or Hey Monday or other kind of very emotive bands of that period.
Let's listen to This Is Forget Me Too. This is with Halsey on Tickets to My Downfall from a couple years ago.
You
I think everything you're saying is dead on. And I also think what a perfect pairing, especially when you get into like the Trippie Redd, Ian Dior collaborations, what an optimal pairing of one person who did not live through OG pop punk, but has like a post MTV kind of like image of it that they are aspiring to, with someone who kind of lived the era, but maybe didn't live the life, but kind of was adjacent to it. It's like both of them are imposing their memories or their invented memories of this scene together. And it's actually maybe more palatable than someone who was truly there trying to collaborate with someone who was not truly there. You have two people who were not truly there, just in different ways. So therefore, everything is fundamentally like a falsity wrapped in a nightmare, wrapped in an invention.
I don't know if either of you saw the movie he released with his last album.
Did I? Come on. I've got it. I have it playing on loop in my office. What are you kidding me?
Not a dry eye in the room when I watched
absolutely
that.
Lil Huddy, just an absolute carved block of wood being maneuvered by a hand. Yes, I have seen this film. Please continue.
I think it fits a lot of Machine Gun Kelly's lyrics and aesthetics in general, in that it feels like a collage of reference points more than a contiguous idea. Like, there's the hospital gown that definitely reverts back to a lot of like Black Parade imagery from My Chemical Romance. But then you have a lot of high school imagery, which is huge from like The Academy Is and basically every pop punk band. And it kind of works because it's everyone looks really good. It doesn't really amount to much is how my take on it, at least.
Also, justice for The Academy Is, just as a sidebar.
I'll say.
Yeah, real talk. But you mentioning those bands in that era actually reminded me of something that has been lurking in the back of my mind that I don't know if it's come up at all in the MGK discourse, which is, okay, so when I started at the paper, I started primarily reviewing concerts. This is like 08, 09. And I remember some of the wildest and most unexpected concert reviewing experiences I had during those first few years were at the Warp Tours of those eras, and really maybe more like 2010 to 2013 Warp Tours. And one of the things that always jumped out at me about those events is there was way more hip hop sneaking into like hardcore band or post hardcore band performances.
Totally.
And I remember, as someone who's coming to it from a hip hop perspective, being like, damn, Pierce the Veil's covering Drake or whatever, something along those lines. It felt really shocking to me. But then, of course, a lot of those bands had really expansive tastes. There were all the Pop Goes Punk compilations. Like, it's, there was already this sense.
You can't forget about Pop Goes Crunk.
Pop Goes Crunk, yes. But so yeah. There's already this sense of omnivorousness and playfulness in the punk and post-hardcore bands of that generation, which I think actually, if we're going to do like the etymology of what happened, a lot of the table setting for like what happened with Lil Peep and Juice WRLD really maybe is traceable to what was happening in like 2011, 2012, 2013 in that Warped Tour space. Were either of you guys there alongside me in those shows?
I missed the Warped Tour.
They were terrible days in the parking lot of like Meadowlands, but like, I'm glad I went.
I didn't do Warped Tour, but I did do Bamboozle, which was a type of like localized Warped Tour.
Like a disease, like a tumor, like localized.
it was our strain of Warped Tour in New Jersey. And Lil Wayne headlined like the year that I went in either 2009, 2010. So the overlap was like both in the sound of the bands itself and in who was performing. And I think that was around the time of his great album Rebirth. A real predecessor.
Tough record.
I can tell you, I caught Wayne in Flint, Michigan, and I want to say 2008 or 2009. It's like wailing on his electric guitar, horribly. But it was maybe like top five concert experiences of my life.
Was he actually playing though?
Oh yeah, you could tell.
So basically what you're saying is that MGK is the true inheritor of Lil Wayne. That's what we're saying.
Well, Travis Barker worked on Rebirth as well. There is a line, if you want to draw it, between that and this. I think Lil Wayne took that in a very much clearly like Joe Satriani, like Santana direction. And MGK is definitely invoking more of, yeah, like Travis Barker's band, Blink 182. But
wait, are you the first person to ever mention Lil Wayne and Joe Satriani in the same sentence? Is that like a, is that a first on earth that's happened?
I hope it was said a lot at the recording of Rebirth, because I don't know who, you know, his mentors were, but it comes out that way to me. But MGK and Travis Barker, something that bothers me about it is I think Travis Barker, and this is true from a lot of his collaborations, I feel like he's almost selling out his own band, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, are we buying any of this stuff, like tickets aside? I mean, are we checking for like JX Din or whatever?
This is a question that I find myself returning to quite a bit, which is, do we believe that Travis Barker is a producer with a particular point of view, or is he a drummer who cannot accommodate a lot of diversity, and therefore the people that he works with tend to mold into a familiar quasi-Blink aesthetic because he is does one thing particularly well from a drumming perspective?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I don't know if he's bringing like a whole banquet of ideas to the table that hits, but it's nice to hear him drum. I will
say it is nice to hear him drum. I agree with that. I find him very soothing, weirdly, as a drummer. There's something very steady and certain and kind of obnoxious about it, but it soothes me personally.
I don't necessarily think he's limited by the genre. You look at the things he's done with like O3 Greedo or Young Thug, but I guess these are all people who also work in that space as well, you know, that like blended genre space. What I've heard, this is Travis Barker's story, is that he has children and they have shown him TikToks of Jaden and Lil Huddy before they were musicians. And that's really where Travis Barker is like, I'm going to mold you into my image of a musician. And that seems to be, yes, the same image stamped over and over again of hot guy with box dye.
Shout out Landon Barker. Definitely the under-discussed link between Travis Barker and the rest of peak TikTok circa 2020. Like, that definitely seems like Landon Barker. And Landon Barker's own TikTok is a revelation in a lot of ways. If you want to see someone grow up into this in real time and, like, invent the character in real time, Landon Barker was doing that all over TikTok 12 to 24 months ago. Speaking of TikTok, just can we briefly sidebar about MGK on TikTok? Okay, so like, look, it's easy. He's sort of like an easy critical punching bag, which is not what we're aspiring to do here today. But I did find him very unexpectedly charming in the context of TikTok, especially when he pushed back against that Guitar Center guy who was like, here's how his guitar works and he doesn't play it. And then MGK like went on and kind of like doused him a little bit. You guys, did you see that when that happened?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a Guitar Center employee, I feel as though you have a duty to know that these things could be modified, bro. Like...
Well, he did apologize. Like, he actually, the Guitar Center guy deleted the video and apologized to MGK.
Oh, good
for
him.
There's a follow, yeah, after MGK completely dunked on him. But I thought he dunked on the Guitar Center guy in such a good-natured way, not in I'm a super famous person and you're like a lowly Guitar Center employee way, but more like you're not the nerd you think you are, which is actually the best way, I think, to ding a nerd is to like let them know that their nerdiness is insufficient. And it actually totally worked. And it actually really warmed me up to MGK, I thought.
One of the most intriguing parts of this press cycle for the past, like for his entirety of his pop punk pivot, has been his relationship to Megan Fox, which, to hear her talk about it, he has like the purest soul she's ever seen. And part of the reason Tickets to My Downfall worked for me, at least, was that it was a softer side of him. You know, it wasn't going to bring me to tears, but it was romantic. And I think his previous albums leaned pretty heavily into like, pretty crass misogyny. And we didn't see as much of that on Mainstream Sellout, I think.
Wait,
and
before we jump to Mainstream Sellout, let's listen to the closing song on Tickets to My Downfall. It's called Play This When I'm Gone. And I believe it's written to his daughter, if I'm not mistaken, or at least a parent to child character. So let's listen to a little bit of Play This When I'm Gone. We'll be right back.
I'm 29 and society's eating me alive. I'm fighting what comes with this notoriety every night. This is the last time I'll ever open up my eyes. I apologize. I'm not gonna lie and tell you it's alright. It's alright. You're gonna cry, and baby, that's alright.
I'm Wesley Morris. I'm a culture writer at the New York Times, where I co-host a podcast called Still Processing. In the broadest sense, it's a show about art and culture, but it's also about going to work and hanging out with your friends and being on the internet. Normally, I do this work with the incomparable Jenna Wortham, but this season, Jenna is off writing a book. So I invited some of my favorite writers and critics and human beings to come hang out with me while she's gone.
Wesley Morris.
Wesley Morris.
Hey, Wesley.
We talk about the culture that shaped us.
The Billboard magazine hits with host Casey Kasem.
The changing ways we consume it.
Now I feel immense guilt for my intro skipping impulses.
And why Keanu Reeves is basically a culture unto himself.
I mean, maybe he's an empty vessel.
You can listen to Still Processing wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Ariel, when we were talking last week about setting this up, like one of the things we were sort of joking about was, oh, you know, we're going to assess MGK like through the lens of like actual emo, like first wave, third wave, ninth wave, whatever. Right. Which like, obviously it's a fool's task. Right. But when I listen to this song, I'm like, not no. Like if this had ended up on some like arbitrary, like, you know, 2007 type record and no one had told me who sang it or it was decontextualized, you could almost believe that it came from the scene, quote unquote. No?
Yeah, I might guess it was like an Armor for Sleep B-side or something. I feel more comfortable even calling it a pop punk revival versus an emo revival. I think those two scenes really merge, in the time that sounds like you were going to those Warped Tour shows in like 2004 to 2008. And speaking of his TikTok, he had what I thought was a charmless TikTok where he was just like, I am not emo enough, and then drew eyeliner all over his face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's really picking up on this kind of culture war, moral panic, I don't know what you want to call it, that certain rock critics picked up in that time of, is this mall punk emo? Is Fall Out Boy emo? Pierce the Veil, all these things that were crossing into more poppy or just different genres. He's more picking up that baton than like, you know, Captain Jazz or some like 90s emo, if folks are keeping score of the wave.
Don't think he's listened to Captain Jazz. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like,
I'd be
don't.
Curious.
MGK, if you're listening, just let us know anything Captain Jazz, maybe anything from the DC area, you know, like when emo was still short for something. If that means anything to you as a reference, MGK, drop us a note. We'd love to hear about it. Do you feel that, and Megan, I wonder if this came up a little bit in your conversation with him. So obviously, coming from hip hop, even though he signed a Bad Boy, but coming from hip hop and never really finding a true foothold in hip hop, he runs up against any number of ceilings or walls or limitations as far as how far he ends up going. And also in a genre which has all these like hidebound ideas often about presentation. Him choosing to make this kind of music, he seems to describe as like a liberation, like finally, like I can do this other thing. I can access this other true part of myself. But then the difference between Tickets to My Downfall and Mainstream Sellout seems to be that he has awoken to the fact that the rules in this genre or on this side are just as hidebound, that the critics, the people who seek to limit him, are just as potent as they ever were on the hip hop side. Did he talk about that at all?
Yes, very much so. I mean, he's very familiar with like the fact that the rock guys don't want him either.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks he's a poser. Everyone thinks this guy's a poser. And there are very cynical ways of reading this transition that I'm not sure I totally believe, but it's certainly possible there's a way in which like rap slash black culture isn't working for me now. Let's move on. There's also a way in which like, hey, Lil Peep died. Let me like put his skin on. That can't be like not stated. But then part of me also believes that this, that all of these things just fell together in the perfect order for him to be himself. But the Peep thing, like, you know.
I always felt like Lil Peep was making, like, essentially, like, the future of Z100, right? Like, in a New York context. Like, the future of pop radio was going to be this hybrid of all these ideas. And when he finally kind of, like, locked in with the right producer, making records at the right scale, that was what he was going to tap into. And I think this, if we're going to think about the arc of that sound, right about now is when I think that sound would have gotten big. And it just so happens that that happened, but there is no Lil Peep. And MGK is like stepping into a pre-existing shift in sonics that he then is riding on top of the wave, that the wave existed before. We'll play one more Tickets to My Downfall track before we pivot back to Mainstream Sellout. And this is with another person who I think occupies a similar space, and that's Black Bear. So let's listen to My Ex's Best Friend, which TBH I think kind of goes. This is My Ex's Best Friend, MGK and Black Bear. Girl, don't act like you ain't saw me. Last year was a mess and how I acted was beyond me. But the past still revolves me. You text me, I ain't responding. But now done changed. Go our separate ways. But look at this damage you did to me. I still want nothing to do between you and me. Please don't say nothing. It all sounds untrue to me. We don't got nothing to say. Black Bear is also a person who I have occasionally listened to and felt the skin of Lil Peep and have struggled with as a listener and critic. But yet somehow him and MGK sound perfectly fine next to each other. And Black Bear also pops up on Mainstream Sellout. All of a sudden you have like a cohort of guys, right? You have Black Bear, you have Ian Dior, you have MGK, you have Mod Sun, you have Travis Barker in the background. All of a sudden this is starting to seem like the starting five of an emergent powerhouse class of people who are potentially setting a template for what pop music, mainstream pop, is going to sound like. When you hear all these folks working together, does that sound promising? Does that sound worrisome? How does it kind of scan to y'all?
Yeah, I think I think that song just won. Travis Barker just might have won like an ASCAP award for My Ex's Best Friend, which is what they consider the best pop songwriting. So there you go.
There you go. There you go. I'm glad to be validated by the big overlords at ASCAP. Love to be in tune with them.
And also Olivia Rodrigo did really well there, who's I think another example for sure of this kind of pivot to maybe like a harsher edge in pop.
All the 12-year-olds who I sat next to at the Portland tour night opener for Olivia Rodrigo, they agree with you. Anyway.
I have some 12-year-old homies who I was talking to about MGK, just for reference.
Of course.
And they were like, I was like, hey guys, do you think it's cool that I'm going to go like to MGK's house? Like, do you think I'm really cool? And they're like, isn't he like 30 and he makes songs about emo girls? These are 12-year-olds. So.
What?
Yeah, man.
Can they call in? Do they want to call in on podcast?
I will say at my Passover Seder, my 12 and 10-year-old cousins would not stop singing Emo Girl just because it's on TikTok. They don't even know, I think, the rest of the song.
I stand by it. I stand by what I wrote when I put it in the playlist a few weeks ago or whatever. I need, this has got to be like in the same way that Netflix had like a Tall Girl movie, there's got to be an Emo Girl movie. I need there to be an Emo Girl movie. Someone has to be writing it right now. This has to be the theme song. This is an order. This is not a request. This is an order. Someone do this.
Emo Girl is such an interesting song on the record for me because I feel like Willow and MGK are two pillars of this emergent scene that we're talking about. I think both are using the sound to very different ends. And I think it kind of shows in that song, which doesn't work well for me because when Willow comes in, she, as silly as the chorus is, has some pretty like great lyrics about same-sex romance, like bringing in kind of elements of her own experience to this scene that I think are desperately needed. I think that's really cool. And then you get MGK on there and he's just kind of talking about doing drugs and being reckless. So I just think it's Willow's music to me reads as a lot more of an attempt at the emotional potency of the original movement, I guess. And I think MGK often is just using guitars because they're high energy and that's the palette that is trending right now, if that makes sense.
So what you're saying is Willow is Vagrant and MGK is Victory? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you said it, not me, but I think that's a good summary. Woo! Of, you know, she's, Willow has also like worked with Avril Lavigne, who I think is a really interesting player in the scene, somebody who was brought back into pop punk after doing like a Christian rock folk record, because, you know, folks like Youngblood and other pop punk revivalists just kept covering her and asking her to kind of return, I guess.
Thank you for mentioning Youngblood. I'd forgotten to include Youngblood in this kind of grouping.
How could you?
I know. No, seriously. It's totally. And in a weird way, I think if you're going to go back to Youngblood, you can almost kind of touch on like the weirder elements of the 1975, kind of like playing in these fringes a touch. Mainstream Sellout is a number one album, but it's not a particularly popular album. They are selling merch bundles to get to number one. It's whatever. It's an old trick. It's Ben Cesario core. It's not a big deal. We're not upset about it. It just is what it is. But it's not particularly radio popular, from what I can tell, ongoing streaming popular. Does the success of Mainstream Sellout actually tell us anything, apart from the fact that MGK is actually fairly savvy? But maybe not deeply gifted.
I think a lot of his sort of pandering appeal is that, I mean, a lot of what we talked about when I was over there was 12-year-olds will come to my show and be like, this is the first time I've ever seen someone play guitar
right
in a live setting before. That has a lot to do with the feeling that a lot of this feels more like a living performance, a conceptual art lifestyle performance of a rock star to people with no context for what a rock star is. And in that sense, to me, the album, especially the Mainstream Sellout album, feels almost like incidental as opposed to the idea of like, I am the guy, I am the rock star. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think that this is traceable back to him playing Tommy Lee in that Motley Crue film, right?
Totally,
kind of feels that. It kind of feels like before he made that movie, I don't think he was waking up every day like, I'm a rock god. Maybe this is all method work, right? Like, he's just like, you do that for 3 months or 4 months.
I really think so. I really think it is. And I think now he's just like, here's what rock stars do. I'm going to give you that.
Are there any songs, Ariel, on Mainstream Sellout that you're like, you know what? This is good. I support this. I'm pro.
Yeah, of course. The thing about Mainstream Sellout to me, I mean, to answer your question quickly, I guess the ones that rip off the most honestly work the best for me. I really like Maybe, and I really like Paper Cuts, which sounds exactly like Green Day. Like Brain Stew.
Before you go on, let's listen to Paper Cuts really fast, because that's dead on. My mind and my heart, but I still put these drugs in my gut. Me and my girl were just screaming at each other right before we both got out of the trunk. I got some demons inside, I'm trying to free them inside. I found the clearly neat side with the boy you was just starving with, you now might try to eat you alive. Damn, y'all said that I switch genres. I saw the limit and took it farther. I'm a genius, could have made Donda, but the song is for my dead father. Oh,
you're flooded with this emerging scene of Youngblood, of Jaden, of Lil Huddy, of all the people we were talking about. I think all that stuff is so watered down that even the slightest bit of heft and emotional weight will, to me, like make something listenable in that regard. So that's what specifically Tickets did for me, but also Mainstream Sellout, where I was like, oh, there's like, you know, Born, like he did a cool intro the same way he did with the last record that was like a little bit quieter. And he has some nice little vocal tics, and it's a fun time. He rested on like the worst laurels of his rap past and of the like misogynistic era of live journal emo in the lyrics of this album. And it made it a tougher sell for me, for sure.
Can we talk about the guitar playing? Because I feel like this came up a little bit when we talked earlier. Your question, I think, was who is playing guitar on this record, correct? We don't
know. Yeah, you hear like on paper cuts at the beginning, those little like flourishes. And I'm just wondering, like, is that MGK? He's the only person I could find credited on any of these songs as like a performer. So I'm curious.
So in the course of that TikTok back and forth with the Guitar Center guy, again, I don't know if I'm reading this correctly, because obviously it's just a famous person like mouthing off on TikTok, like who really knows if he's speaking in the most precise, detailed fashion. But he basically says, I only play my guitar live. He says that in the TikTok. And then in the response where the Guitar Center guy is apologizing, the Guitar Center guy pulls up some like live footage of MGK absolutely butchering a guitar part. And the Guitar Center guy is like, I do apologize to Mr. Kelly. I can confirm that is definitely being played live.
It's like when you saw Lil Wayne back, yes. You're like, I know he's playing.
Okay, so if MGK plays live, but according to this TikTok, only Blaze's guitar live, then the most competent guitar work on this album maybe is unlikely to be played by MGK. Yeah. That's my takeaway.
There's a feller called Omer Fetty, yes. And he, I believe, does the guitar on the album.
Mr. Addison Rae?
Yeah. Yes.
When we were just talking about kind of the performance of rock, I can't find the exact quote, but there's like a quote from MGK floating around, like, I might not be the best person at guitar, but I look the best doing it, which, you know, isn't wrong. And
how could you not like someone who says that?
It's exactly what Megan's talking about. Like, it's a level of self-deprecation that's kind of necessary at his point and makes it easier to kind of swallow the music he puts out, I think. And he's also just, I think, a little confused. He said things about how like Kurt Cobain didn't care how things sounded. He just cared about the emotion. And that guy's a noted perfectionist. Like, yeah, I think it's this fake nostalgia.
Kurt Cobain didn't want things to sound clean. That doesn't mean he didn't care about how it sounded. Those are two different things. Not to be all like, let me tell you about grunge, Mr. Machine Gun Kelly, but like,
we could talk about like the fashion of this movement for a long time. Yes. But I think it's way more 90s grunge meets Robert Smith than it is something that, I don't know, anybody might consider pop punk or emo nostalgia to me.
You mean the aesthetics of how the people who are making music in this space currently dress?
Yeah, or even the fonts they're choosing on album covers. It's much more in line with, like, you know, Cocteau Twins or goth than it would be with emo at that time. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. It's
even like Warped Tour kids were not wearing like bondage pants. You know what I mean? Like they were just, they were wearing skinny jeans. Like they were wearing skinny jeans and Vans. Like it was like, they were not aesthetic. Like I remember looking at a lot of these bands and kind of just being thinking like, damn, I wish some of these bands had real aesthetics. They seem pretty committedly, in my perspective, anti-aesthetic, obviously not counting like MCR and folks like that.
And that anti-aesthetic was a choice, you know? Sorry, now I'm getting on my high horse about like
go in.
Early emo, but that, you know, aesthetic on behalf of even the Descendants, this kind of square aesthetic that we saw popularized in emo, was an aesthetic choice against punk and other scenes that were kind of dressing purposely in a more classic, like Motley Crue hair metal way. I think that emo's dress in the late 90s, early 2000s with Converse, skinny jeans, hoodies was a purposeful like retreat into nerdiness and like an embrace of nerdiness. And I think a lot of this context gets lost is all. I'm not saying that Machine Gun Kelly has to go walking around with like a chrome bag around his shoulder or something, but it's.
I dare you to go to the chrome store and buy a bag.
Yeah. Misses the mark a bit, I guess.
But also like, you know, as someone who I feel like has been paying attention for, you know, 30 or 35 years of like watching pop stardom, there will always be a kind of purposeful misinterpretation of source material if it gets you kind of over the hump into the promised land. And back, you know, back in the 90s or even the early 2000s, I personally used to feel like a tremendous amount of anxiety. I'd be like, oh, this person has changed the way that they dress or invented a different approach that's different from the scene that they're originally from, and that reflects on them poorly. And maybe I'm just old at this point, but I'm just kind of like, you should do that. Like, if you want to be this kind of like mainstream chode, like this is actually, this is like, this is required. This is obligatory. This is actually, to Megan's point before, this is the performance. And if you're not doing this, then actually you're not living up to whatever your potential is. And in the case of MGK, I don't think the potential is musical potential so much as imagistic potential.
Sure. And not to mention, I mean, do we have subcultures anymore? Those old anxieties about changing your look were tied to like where someone fit in a subculture versus the mainstream. I don't think we have that anymore. So why care?
I'm just saying, I understand the point is taken. And that's, and MGK success is actually, I think you're right. It's kind of like, it's not the death knell of subculture, but it is someone who has pieced together pre-existing quote-unquote subcultures and basically woven it into a tapestry that has suddenly become incredibly pop and popular or quasi-popular. And none of it has any meaning. It's not connected. Megan, do you think these 12-year-olds who never saw a guitar before an MGK show, they're going to go and make the next Captain Jazz? Like, they're going to go, like, learn guitar and then, like, make the new Captain Jazz in, like, 2027 or something?
I'd love to say yes, but, you know, something that actually disappointed me about the mainstream sellout album and this ecosystem that we were talking about of Black Bear and whoever, I'm not excited anymore about, oh wow, this has trap drums and it has guitars. It's, whoa, there's both. To me, that's so played out, can't talk about it anymore. Genre bending, like, we've done this. I would be thrilled if someone could pick a lane as opposed to like, whoa, we've got synths and trap drums and like all of it. It's like, dude, who cares? Like, that's everything. That's what everything
is. Are you telling
me
you just want to listen to Griselda records? That's all you want?
I just want to restore the feeling, man.
Like, literally, Benny the Butcher is like waiting on the sidelines, like just like waiting just for everybody to burn this out of their system. He's like, real rap's coming back, real rap's coming back, real rap's coming back. It's my turn.
No, I just want people to stop speaking as though it's impressive that like people have managed to like put rap sounds and rock sounds and electronic sounds together. Like, we gotta
also
let it go.
I have three words to say to anybody who thinks that they did it first, and those words are Judgment Night soundtrack. So I'm just saying, anybody who is thinking they're out here on the cultural vanguard, I hope that they are listening to De La Soul and Teenage Fan Club right now as we speak. Tell me, Megan, what's like, is there a standout track for you on Mainstream Sellout that we haven't talked about yet?
I'm a fan of the intro, actually.
Let's listen to it. Born with Horns, the OG title and tattoo.
Yeah.
Part one, why is it so hard to live?
Part two,
I shouldn't have done what I did.
Part three,
everyone left me alone.
Part four,
I don't want to live anymore.
Yeah.
I'd rather be a freak than somebody's puppet. Release your leash, I don't belong in the circus. They cut each my wings, so if my name was incursive. Now I'm 6 feet deep, I guess my life wasn't perfect.
Before we wrap up, I wanted this to be like as generous as possible to the MGK phenomenon, but ultimately it does feel like there is something a little bit hollow at its core. Do we see this being something that a year from now we're going to look back and be like, God, remember when MGK had two number one albums in a row that were kind of like pop punk mall goth? Like, that was weird. But do you think that we're going to look back on it as a blip, or is it somehow template setting moving forward?
A really great piece of context is that up until Machine Gun Kelly had the number one album, it was the Encanto soundtrack for damn near like 4 months. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we're up against right now. So, no, I don't think any of this is a blip in anything. I think we've lost the plot. Pop culturally, but that's another conversation.
So the other thing about this, right, is that MGK released both his albums and they're classified on Billboard as rock albums. So he effectively has like two number one rock albums in a row, which is unheard of in recent history, or two number one albums that were rock, I guess. And I think the last number one rock album, I believe, was AC/DC. So it's coming from both sides in that I think, yeah, culture is kind of lost the plot. I think you put it well, but also rock is so is so ossified that it's hard to contextualize MGK in any kind of living history of rock, if that makes sense, because it's all going to be Foo Fighters and AC/DC until, you know, Black Bear gets in there. So,
but I think to that point, and again, I think this cannot go understated, and we've alluded to it a little bit before, but if you are willing to accept that MGK, with his particular stew of influences, has made a quote-unquote rock record, are we going to also accept on some level Young Thug's Punk as a rock record? Are we going to accept the various Juice WRLD albums as rock records? The 24K Golden Ian Dior albums as rock records? Like, I think if you look at the current iteration of Alternative Press, the magazine, I feel like they've leaned pretty heavy into these kinds of sounds and said, you know what, this is part of the lineage now. But I don't think like the charts, quote unquote, reflect that. So I think if you're going to look through the lens of like Peep, SoundCloud Rap, Peep, Juice WRLD, X, et cetera, if you're going to say, is rock happening? It actually has been happening. It just has not been happening in the way that MGK has packaged it or repackaged it, I should say. So maybe it's less that rock is ossified and more that people are not seeing the rock kind of hiding in plain sight as it has been for the last few years.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think that's a good point. I think that speaks to his kind of opportunistic framing of all this as well, because he's far from the first person or the best person to be doing this type of music. But, you know, he can claim he's bringing back rock because the charts say that, you know, so.
Best marketing, best tattoos. That is our show. Thank you, Ariel. Thank you, Megan, for coming through and talking about MGK, the goat no cap of pop punk, mall goth, hip hop rock. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/popcast. Email us popcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Tell me which signifiers you apply to MGK when you are talking about them with your 12-year-old homies. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Google, yada, 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 yada. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with something that MGK should listen to and cover. This is Cat and Jazz, Oh Messy Life.